Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Pete Anderson. Today I'll be reading from the Hartford Business Journal. The first story we're going to look at today is titled Under the Wire. This story is subtitled Connecticut Employee Poaching Lawsuit Filed Days Before FTC Ban Ruling Provides Window into Debate Over Non-Compete Agreements. Farmington-based healthcare digital marketing agency recently sued a competitor, claiming it poached a top employee in an effort to steal clients and gain inside knowledge of its business and offerings. In its lawsuit, Primacy LLC, based at 1577 New Britain Avenue, named former employee Matt Sear of South Carolina and Unlock Health, based in Nashville, Tennessee, as plaintiffs. The case, which recently reached an undisclosed settlement, is noteworthy because it involved contract breach allegations, including violations of non-compete agreements and other restrictive covenants that have come under scrutiny on the state and federal levels in recent weeks and months. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court for the District of Connecticut on April 17th, just 6 days before the Federal Trade Commission issued a ruling that banned most forms of non-compete agreements between employers and employees. The new rule, which has touched off an intense debate over the fairness of and need for non-compete agreements, was published in the Federal Register on May 7th and is scheduled to take effect 120 days after, on September 4th, though there are active legal challenges to it. Some legal experts say the ban may get overturned and never go into effect. The FTC's new rule treats some non-compete agreements differently from others, allowing those for senior executives to remain in force while ruling those for other workers unenforceable. Primacy's 47-page lawsuit provides a window into how and why employers use non-compete clauses. The suit describes Sear as a senior-level marketing executive and stated that he worked for Primacy or its predecessor in a top leadership role for 7 years. Sear was originally hired as a strategic lead vice president or vice president of strategy by Farmington-based Axis Incorporated in August 2016, the suit notes. 6 years later, in June 2022, Axis merged with Primacy. The deal included the transfer of all Axis employees and all rights under any contracts to Primacy. The company claims Sear was intimately familiar with every aspect of Primacy's sales and marketing strategy, as well as with its clients and specific projects being developed for them. That included spearheading the development of a suite of services to be offered to Primacy's clients through the use of artificial intelligence, it states. Unlock Health began recruiting Sear in February 2024, when he documented a call with that company by typing notes on his Primacy work email and sending them to his personal email, the lawsuit states. During that initial conversation, the suit contended, Sear spoke with Unlock Health about his ability to take clients with him, the name and contact person of a Primacy client, and plans to capitalize on artificial intelligence. There was also a notation in the email indicating some discussion of a non-compete, non-solicit employees and clients. Sear's employment agreement with Primacy contained all three of these restrictive covenants, the lawsuit notes, referring to the employee confidentiality, non-solicitation, and non-compete agreements. Unlock Health was formed in April 2023 by the merger of healthcare marketing services firm Decode and Eruptor, according to an announcement issued at the time. 7 months later, Unlock Health announced it had acquired SPM Group, a network of health and healthcare agencies, saying the acquisition brought an incredible depth of expertise and marketing capability to the Unlock platform. In April of this year, the company announced that it was unifying under the Unlock Health brand. When Sear spoke to Unlock Health in February, the lawsuit stated, that company was undaunted by Sear's non-compete and non-solicit as to clients and employees, and spoke with Sear about what they could offer him and what he could offer to them. Primacy claimed that after Sarah provided the client name and contact person to Unlock Health, he followed up on March 11th by soliciting that client via email and telling them he was leaving to join Unlock Health. Sear emailed notes about that call to his personal email, Primacy stated, adding that his notes also suggested he should speak to Unlock Health CEO Brandon Edwards about artificial intelligence. How are you capitalizing on this? Primacy stated that it inferred that to mean that Sear intended to help Unlock Health with their AI offerings to clients. The lawsuit claimed that Sear, who worked remotely but had full access to Primacy's computer systems, engaged in several other acts of misconduct, including sending confidential company information to his personal email. He also attempted to cover his tracks by deleting approximately 15,000 emails from his work email account, Primacy claimed. According to the lawsuit, Sear submitted a resignation letter on March 5th that indicated his last day of Primacy would be March 15th. The lawsuit also accused Sear of not returning any of the documents emailed to his personal email address to Primacy. The lawsuit added that according to his LinkedIn page, Sear joined Unlock Health as a head of integrated marketing group. That listing is no longer part of his LinkedIn profile. Instead, above the listing for the past 3 years at Primacy, he described himself only as a public speaker, artificial intelligence, and as a part-time independent consultant. Unlock Health is not mentioned at all. Primacy stated in its lawsuit that it was seeking a jury trial as well as an injunctive relief and damages from both Sear and Unlock Health, including for violation of the Connecticut Uniform Trade Secrets Act and the Federal Defend Trade Secrets Act. Primacy also requested a temporary restraining order, preliminary injunction, and permanent injunction against Sear to keep him from work for Unlock Health or any other similar entity for the full term of the restriction, as well as to prevent him from luring any Primacy employees and to require him to maintain confidentiality of Primacy information. The lawsuit also sought actual compensatory and exemplary damages to be determined at trial. The negotiated settlement was reached in the case in late May, but details were not available. Attorneys representing Primacy, Unlock Health, and Sear did not respond to requests for comment. While the case has been settled, its timing giving the FTC's pending ban raised questions not just about the validity of most non-compete agreements, but also about the ability of businesses to protect proprietary information. Salvatore Gangemi, a partner with the law firm of Mirtha Kalina LLP, who was not involved with the Primacy case, said one key aspect of the lawsuit would have been whether the FTC's non-compete ban would apply. While Primacy described Sear as a senior executive, which would make his non-compete agreement enforceable under the FTC ban, the rule provides a specific definition that must be met, Gangemi said. In order to be considered a senior executive under the ban, he would have to be earning over $151,164 per year, he said, of Sear. In addition, Sear would have to have had final authority to make policy decisions that control significant aspects of the business entity and does not include authority limited to advising or exerting influence over such policy decisions. Since the case was settled before it went to trial, we don't know whether Sear earned the requisite salary and or had the type of final authority required to be considered a senior executive, Gangemi said. But if he did, the FTC ban would have no effect on him for his breach, he said. If Sear was not a senior executive, however, then several aspects of his restrictive covenants could not be enforced, including the non-compete clause, Gangemi said. The FTC's ban does not expressly prohibit clauses that bar the solicitation of employees or customers, but it does make clear that if a non-solicitation clause functions as a non-compete, then the clause would be invalid, he said. Still, the FTC's ruling does not mean employees can't absconded with confidential information or trade secrets, but Yanyemi believes the non-compete ban could make it significantly harder for employers to prevent it. The FTC ban disregards an employee's difficulty in protecting its confidential information or trade secrets, he said. Under the current law, non-competes that exist for these purposes are perfectly legitimate as long as the employee was aware of the confidential information or trade secrets and could potentially use such information for the benefit of another employer. Yanyemi said the FTC's ban will require employers to come up with different ways to prevent the theft of such information without outright prohibiting an employee from working for a subsequent employer. In other words, he said, employers would have to prove that a sharing of such information with a new employer actually occurred. This is not easy to do, and without initial proof that it has happened, would likely make it more difficult for an employer to secure a temporary injunction. By the time the employer learned of the misappropriation, he added, it might be too late to protect itself. You can't unring a bell. Turning now to our next story from the Hartford Business Journal. This story is titled, Hidden Gems. The story is subtitled, From Pizza to Oysters, Connecticut focuses on smaller attractions to boost tourism efforts. Oysters have been harvested from Connecticut waters for thousands of years. New Haven has produced world-famous pizza for more than a century. But can these mainstays of the Connecticut economy and culture help draw more tourists to the Nutmeg State? State and local officials think so, and they're looking to add native gems like pizzerias, oyster farms, and other smaller attractions to the growing list of popular Connecticut tourist destinations, hoping to boost the overall number of visitors to the state while also attracting more residents and businesses. U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro, a Democrat from Connecticut, in May entered an official statement into the congressional record declaring New Haven the pizza capital of the United States. A pizza delegation of state officials, restaurants, and tourism industry leaders traveled to Washington, D.C. for that event. Also last month, the State Department of Economic and Community Development, or DECD, released a short film about the aquaculture industry to coincide with the debut of Connecticut's first oyster trail, highlighting local oyster farms, seafood markets, and restaurants. The film, Raising Tide to Table, was directed by the state's chief marketing officer, Anthony Anthony, who said tourism continues to be a major focus area for the state economic development officials. Former DECD Commissioner Alexandra Daum, in outlining tourism as one of her top priorities, said smaller or lesser-known attractions deserve some of the spotlight as they collectively contribute to the state's economic vitality and help attract visitors and residents. Anthony joined the Lamont administration under Daum in early 2023 when he learned that the state tourism objectives were intertwined with other DECD efforts to recruit businesses, grow jobs, and make Connecticut a desirable place to live, work, and play. Since then, Anthony has helped spearhead marketing efforts, including the launch of a new Make It Here statewide branding campaign that aims to bolster not only outsiders' perception of Connecticut, but also raise and leverage home state pride. Connecticut's identity is that of creators, makers, innovators, and entrepreneurs, he said. The marketing plan included giving Connecticut a strong identity and making people think of us as a place to visit and incorporating stops to smaller boutique and craft attractions while here. And if we do all that, it will help us grow the economy, Anthony added. For native and longtime nutmeggers, New Haven's reputation for outstanding pizza is well known. Sally's a Pizza in New Haven is one of the many historic pizzerias along Worcester Street that has helped the Elm City to earn a reputation. Sally's took part in the pizza delegation trip to Washington, D.C., along with other popular New Haven establishments such as Frank Pepe's Pizza, Modern Pizza, Pizza at the Brick Oven, Next Door Big Green Truck Pizza, Bar, SSS Pizza, and Cast Iron Chef Chop House. DeLauro said the state's more than 1,300 pizza-making establishments are the most of any state per capita, and they produce more than 150 million pizzas annually, equaling $3.5 billion in sales. New Haven's 75 pizzerias generate over $100 million in annual sales, feeding 2 million customers annually, she said. New Haven Mayor Justin Elliker said the city's pizzerias are local, national, and international destinations. Sally's and Pepe's have been on Worcester Street for decades, and their growing popularity in recent years convinced them both to expand with new locations throughout New England and beyond. Pepe's now has eateries as far away as Virginia and Florida. Sally's has three locations in Connecticut and one in Massachusetts, with five more in the development pipeline. Christian Bonaventura, a spokesperson for Sally's, said the pizzeria's original and new locations have contributed to steady growth, with a higher percentage of tourists visiting the Worcester Street site, while the new locations are more popular with local customers. Bonaventura said Sally's revenues have grown more than tenfold from adding new locations. The average unit volume for Sally's is more than $3.8 million per restaurant locations, he said. Anthony said the attractions like Worcester Street in New Haven or local seafood stops that help tourism officials plant these little flags in places where we know we can not only stand out, but also help us market ourselves better. The timing for promoting the oyster industry is also strategic. Anthony said as the industry is likely to get a boost from recent legislative changes, a bill passed in 2021, for example, extended decades-old protections that allow aquaculture lands to be classified as farms and subject to reduced property tax rates. Legislation passed last year allows the Department of Agriculture to designate oyster harvesting areas in waters under state jurisdiction. That will ensure preservation of the industry longer term, officials said. The state has 61,000 acres of shellfish farms, which generates over $30 million in annual sales. Oyster sales alone reached $14.6 million in 2023, according to the Department of Agriculture. Just over $30,000 went into production of the Oyster documentary and development of Oyster Trail, Anthony said. The trail includes a map that charts more than 12 oyster farms and 20 restaurants and seafood markets in the state. Meantime, the state spent $5,000 to charter the Avino Airlines flight to D.C. for the pizza delegation. While it's difficult to gauge the impact of each individual campaign, efforts to broaden the state's tourism have been effective, Anthony said. In 2023, the state had its best year ever for the number of visitors at just under 68 million, while lodging revenues increased to more than $1.3 billion, he said. The state's tourism website had 9.4 million visitors in 2023, up 32% from the previous year, Anthony said. State officials are also doing more with less, he noted. Neighboring Maine spent more than $20 million on its tourism efforts versus Connecticut's $4.5 million tourism department budget in 2023. Jan Jones is a lecturer and professor of hospitality and tourism management at the University of New Haven's Pompeia College of Business. She also serves on the State Tourism Coalition, Connecticut Hospitality Education Federation, and the Connecticut Meetings Board. She said promoting smaller destinations can have a broader effect on the state's tourism efforts. People who might come for pizza and then stay for ice cream or shopping. So there's a lot of cross-collaboration, which is why it's important to promote these, Jones said. One challenge, Jones says, is measuring the tourism impact of smaller attractions like pizza parlors or oyster dinners. But with the advances in data analytics, it could become easier to do that in the future. As analytic data improves, we're going to see more and more of that kind of data collection, being able to track where the visitors are coming from, whether Connecticut or out of state, Jones said. As the power of analytics and looking at the data grows, tourism figures and efforts are going to actually only improve. Turning now to our next story from the Hartford Business Journal. This story is titled Wealth Transfer. This story is subtitled, Law Firms Expand to Florida as Ultra-Wealthy Connecticut Residents Seek Relief Amid Looming Estate Tax Exemption Sunset. Law firms in Connecticut are expanding to Florida, and it's not just for warmer weather and renowned beaches, but largely because of the financial incentives that are attracting their clients to the Sunshine State. For decades, Connecticut residents have been taking up residency in Florida, where there's no income tax, their money has more purchasing power, and more importantly, for the ultra-wealthy families, there's no estate tax. Law firms are aware of the migration trend and are following their clients as they move sometimes to change their permanent residency, other times to buy a second or third vacation home. My opinion is that it would be wonderful to be wherever our clients like to be, said Dane Dudley, chair of law firm Day Pitney Private Client Department. But the resources are such that you just can't do that. Day Pitney has strategically expanded to locations where their clients' legal needs are the greatest. The firm has more than 300 attorneys across 13 offices in 6 states, Connecticut, Florida, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island, and in Washington, D.C. Day Pitney, which has a prominent presence in Hartford, provides a variety of legal services from estate planning to litigation. Over the last 5 years, its attorney count in Florida has increased from 15 to 30. Through the expansion, Day Pitney seeks to provide a continuity of services to clients leaving the Nutmeg State. If a client was in Connecticut, New York, or Massachusetts, and they moved to Florida, you don't lose any of that institutional knowledge, said Dudley, a partner at the firm's West Hartford office. At least at our firm, we operate off the same system, he said, so there's consistency in the documents themselves. They don't have to network and redraft everything. It's usually amending things to take into consideration the change of the law firm from Connecticut to Florida, for example. Day Pitney established its presence in Florida in 2016 through a merger with Florida-based firm Chapin, Bolero, and Cheeselack. The combined firm retained existing offices at Delray Beach, which has since closed, and Boca Raton, along with several Florida-based attorneys who joined Day Pitney's trust and estates and corporate practices. 2 years later, Day Pitney completed its second Florida expansion, merging with South Florida-based law firm Richmond Greer. The merger added 2 more Florida offices to Day Pitney's roster in Miami and West Palm Beach, along with 15 attorneys. Services go where people are, said Tasha Dickinson, a partner at Day Pitney's West Palm Beach office. Strategically, it made sense for Day Pitney to expand in Florida, particularly in the private client service arena, because a lot of people moving to Florida were high net worth, either still working or post-liquidation of a business. So there was a need both on the pre-death side, and unfortunately those people die and their families need services post-death as well. Clients' legal needs include taxes, trust and estates, and family offices. The number of people moving to Florida has increased dramatically in recent years, Dickinson said, and it's more often younger people pursuing life changes in addition to tax benefits. Now a typical client would be moving their business and their family to Florida, she noted. Over a 10-year period ending in 2022 and excluding the pandemic year of 2020, Connecticut lost a net of 71,044 residents to Florida, according to an HBJ analysis of U.S. Census Bureau data. During that time period, 132,988 former Connecticut residents moved to Florida, while 62,210 former Sunshine State residents relocated to Connecticut, HBJ's analysis found. In early May, New Haven-based law firm Wiggin & Dana announced that it was absorbing Ellis Law Group, a boutique trust and estates firm with four attorneys based in Boca Raton, Florida. Ellis Law Group specialized in setting up trust and planning estates, as well as asset and wealth projection, business succession planning, and general business counsel. Wiggin and Dana said the investment in Florida was driven by the upcoming sunset of the $13.61 million per person federal estate tax exemption. On January 1, 2026, the exemption is expected to drop to $5.6 million per person. Connecticut's estate tax exemption is tied to the federal level, so as of January 1, 2026, Connecticut's estate tax exemption will drop to $5.6 million as well. At the current level, an heir of the descendant may receive up to $13.61 million without paying the federal or state estate tax in Connecticut. However, after January 1, 2026, that will change. Typically, after credits are applied, the federal estate tax rate is about 40%, and Connecticut's estate tax rate is an additional 10%, said Heather Rhodes, chair of the Stanford law firm of Cummings and Lockwood's Private Clients Group. Notwithstanding potential congressional action to extend the $13.61 million federal exclusion, more Connecticut estates soon will be subject to both the federal and state income taxes, which can devour roughly 50% of their value. Connecticut's estate and gift tax generated $218.35 million in revenue in 2022-2023, according to a report from the Department of Revenue Services. That same year, there were 54 tax returns filed for estates worth $10 million to $15 million, 28 returns for estates worth $15 million to $25 million, and 28 returns for estates over $25 million, according to the Department of Revenue Services. There are questions about whether Connecticut could decouple its estate tax exemption from the federal level to help prevent wealthy families from potentially leaving. Governor Ned Lamont's office didn't respond to a request for comment on whether there has been any consideration of that issue. But law firms are preparing for an influx of clients trying to minimize the potential tax impact. Our high net worth clients are thinking more urgently about their estate planning ahead of the 2025 tax sunset, said Seth Ellis, who founded Ellis Law Group in 1999 and is now a Wiggin and Dana partner at its Boca Raton office. The federal exemption nearly doubled to a historical high under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, just 2 months after Connecticut tied its exemption to the federal threshold. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act took effect in 2018. Prior to 2018, Connecticut's exemption stood at $2 million for nearly 15 years. Well, that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the Hartford Business Journal. I'm Pete Anderson. So long until next time.